Welcome to Life, Liberty, Reason. I'm James Elias. Thank you for joining my journey through the history of philosophy. Each week, we'll explore the ideas of men in history who have defined the way we think. The sources for the program can be found in the description below the player on Blog Talk Radio. This week, we will subject ourselves to the philosopher who wanted nothing less than the destruction of the entire universe. After Kant said that reason cannot know true reality, but only the world of appearances, Hegel attempted to develop a new kind of logic in hopes that such a logic would actually have access to reality. Kant basically, by invalidating traditional Aristotelian logic, Hegel invented dialectic logic, hoping that this would actually give us some kind of insight into the noumenal world. Now, because of this denial of reason, it wasn't long until some irrational crazy men took advantage of this situation and claimed that their emotions had direct access to true reality. Now that reason had been invalidated, people in effect said, you know, well, sometimes I do feel like I know stuff, but reason, according to Kant, tells us that we can't know stuff. So, it must be my emotions that really give me this feeling that I know the world. It must be that I know the world through emotions. To put it in Kant's terminology, we do have access to the noumenal realm, and this access comes to us through our feelings, our instincts, our intuitions, emotions. Kant actually did hint at this in his own Ethics. Kant basically said that in the phenomenal realm, it is the case that acting morally, according to Kant, actually hurts you. And Kant basically says there's no way that this is just, and so it must be that in the noumenal realm, in the world of things in and of themselves, acting justly or acting virtuously, as Kant described it, would actually be good for you, because Kant recognized that acting according to his morality in this world, in the phenomenal world, totally wrecks your life. And so he kind of made this argument that you could know something about the noumenal world directly. Kant basically said there must be an afterlife in the noumenal world, in the real world. There must be some kind of just remuneration for those who act morally in the noumenal world. So he claimed to know something about the noumenal world through an iffy argument, and so it wasn't too long until people started claiming knowledge of the noumenal world through no argumentation whatsoever. Schopenhauer was one of such crazy men who came to be known as the Romanticists, those who value emotion over reason. The Romanticists basically saw reason as, like, basically not part of your actual soul. The reason they called themselves Romanticists is because they believed that your feelings are your actual will. They kind of package-dealed your emotions, your passions, in with your will. And basically said, you know, if you follow reason, you're kind of acting as an automaton, because you're just acting by some kind of automatic process of logic, and you're not. But if you act according to your emotions, you're acting according to who you really are, what you really will. What's funny is that Kant actually argues the reverse. So does Hegel. Kant and Hegel both argue completely the reverse. They argue that the only way you can express your free will, or as Kant called it, autonomy, is if you act according to your duty. If you act according to your emotions or your desires, he dealt, you know, rational values in with whims. And so he says if you basically act according to your desires, according to your self-interest, then you're acting as nothing more than an animal. Of course, it's not in man's self-interest to act like an animal hedonist, but, you know, we'll get to that later when we discuss rational egoism in objectivism. Kant construed animalistic egoism and rational egoism as being basically the same thing, and he basically said that if you're acting according to your selfish desires, then you are no more than an automaton. You're acting according to your automatic instinct. Whereas if you act according to duty, you are expressing control over your person. You are expressing autonomy. Hegel had a similar idea. He said that, you know, your real will isn't what you individually will. Your will is actually what the state wills, because for Hegel, the individual was not quite real. It's actually, remember, all individuals are actually part of Hegel's absolute, and the state is an expression of the absolute. So when the state forces you to do something, it's actually forcing you to be free. You might be against Napoleon, but really the state is in favor of Napoleon. So by forcing you to, you know, cheer along and say, yay, Napoleon, or yay, Stalin, or yay, Hitler, you're actually being forced to be free, because you are expressing the true will of the state, and that is enthusiasm for the local dictator. Let's now turn to Schopenhauer and his romanticism, his focus on the feelings. Schopenhauer believed, similarly to Hegel, that the universe was basically one big consciousness. There was a small twist to this. Schopenhauer believed that the universe was this consciousness or this will. Schopenhauer liked to equate consciousness with will or volition or, you know, what or desire. This will is irrational. It doesn't even follow some kind of mixed-up dialectic logic like Hegel's universe consciousness. It's just a completely irrational consciousness. It doesn't have any kind of... It has desires, but its desires are fundamentally irrational, mixed up. They don't really... it doesn't really desire anything in particular. Basically, it has a desire only to continue desiring. And as a result of this, it's constantly being frustrated. It never knows what it wants. It's always striving towards something, never getting it. It's basically like the universe is one big, like, eternal cock tease, basically. As a result of this metaphysical, universal frustration, the world, for each of us being just a expression, an individual expression of the universal desire, you can see this sort of denial of the individual self, again expressed in Schopenhauer, as it was expressed in Hegel. As a result of this metaphysical, frustration, life for each individual person is absolutely meaningless misery for all eternity, for all of us. We feel these desires, Schopenhauer would say, and we constantly stress out about trying to get these desires, and we stress, and during those rare moments when we actually achieve our goal, we find that all it does is just give us a sort of a momentary relief from this stress for a few moments until we go back to desiring the next thing. So basically, this is this notion that desire is the root of all suffering and misery. And so not only does that apply to the individual for Schopenhauer, but it also applies to the universe at large. The individual and the universe are both constantly striving towards the next thing, always stressing out about it, always desiring, always being frustrated, never getting it. And then once they do, it's just on to the next thing that they're frustrated about. It's like Sisyphus. It's like the myth of Sisyphus applied to the universe as a whole. Sisyphus is, by the way, a Greek myth where this poor dude, he pissed off the gods, I forgot how, but the gods sentenced him to an eternity of rolling a rock uphill. They basically said, if you can get that rock to the top of the hill, we'll let you go. And so Sisyphus, he's very strong, and so he's able to roll this giant-ass rock up the hill. But every time he's almost about to reach the finish line, the rock just suddenly, inexplicably rolls all the way down the hill. And so Sisyphus is charged with an eternity of rolling this frickin' rock up the hill forever and ever. That's basically the view of existence that Schopenhauer had. Now, what was Schopenhauer's proof of this, that the world is just one big consciousness? None. Remember, Schopenhauer is an irrationalist. He's a romanticist who believes, he believes that reason is incapable of knowing anything, and so we use our emotions to gain knowledge about fundamental philosophical truths. Schopenhauer's statements are not to be taken as scientific as a result of this, or even as some kind of concrete, straightforward knowledge of reality. not even the type that you'd find in Revelation. The Bible, Revelation, gives, you know, it's not reason-based, but it does give you this concrete, straightforward structure that the universe is supposed to have. There's a God, he snapped his fingers, and, well, he snapped his fingers, you know, on six different occasions, six different days, and then that brought the, and then, you know, the fish came in, and then the water came in. You know, there's a certain order to it. You know, Jesus was brought down to cleanse us of our sins. There's, you know, this very, you know, straightforward system that all of this is supposed to occur. Schopenhauer's insights into physical, I guess not physical, but like, you know, reality, you know, which the conscious reality that is this world, are not to be considered even like revelation. They're just kind of the way he feels. And so he doesn't make argumentation. He kind of just, he talks about this way he feels. And he basically just expects the reader to sort of say, oh, hey, I kind of feel the same way, and to sort of agree with him on that basis. His words are supposed to trigger in you a kind of, you know, feeling that would make you realize, oh, yeah, I kind of have felt this all along. And that probably is, in fact, the mechanism by which Schopenhauer ends up appealing to some people. Let's see. Schopenhauer didn't just disbelieve reason. He actively thought that reason was a corrupting influence. He believed that knowing something using reason basically ruins your true knowledge of it. This is the sort of thing he didn't say this, but this is the kind of thing that you'd say. If you focus on the reason that plants produce flowers, you know, you're Mendel, say, and you're really, oh, they produce flowers to reproduce, and the bees, you know, grab their pollen, and then they, you know, fly into other flowers. If you fixate on this and how this all works, then you're not going to be able to focus on how the flower makes you feel. And so, therefore, you're missing out on the real knowledge that you can gain from the flower. Maybe some sort of sense of, although Schopenhauer wouldn't say this because he was a metaphysical pessimist, maybe the beauty that the flower entails. Although Schopenhauer was, he did believe that man could experience a brief relief from the misery that is life by having an aesthetic experience. So maybe he would be in favor of, you know, just viewing the beauty of a flower. But the point here is that he would be actively against studying it. He would believe that it actually hurts you, or it actually prevents you from gaining the true knowledge that is possible through your feelings and emotions. One way to sort of demonstrate this is a poem by Wordsworth. And I'll read the parts of it that I don't find too boring. This is a poem called "The Tables Turned." Up, up, my friend, and quit your books. Oh, surely you'll grow double. Up, up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble? So it's saying, you know, stop looking at your books. Stop trying to understand reality. The sun above, the mountain's head, a refreshing luster meadow, through all this long green fields has spread his first sweet evening yellow. Books! 'Tis a dull and endless strife. Come here, the woodland linnet. How sweet his music on my life. There's more of wisdom in it. So he's saying, go out into the woods and just listen to the, you know, the birds chirping, the insects buzzing, and that will give you more knowledge, more wisdom than reading about this stuff in books. And hark, how blithe the throstle sings. He too is no mean preacher. Come forth into the light of things. Let nature be your teacher. She has a world of ready wealth. Of my blah, blah, blah. I mean, I'm gonna skip to the good part. Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect. Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect. Enough of science and art. Close up those barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives. So the main, I really like this line. I mean, no, I don't like it, but I find it very exemplative. That's not a word. I find this to be very demonstrative of this view. We murder to dissect. In order to, you know, in order to examine a bird, Aristotle had to go out and kill it in order to dissect it and look at all of its organs and all that stuff. And so this is very much, you know, this is not argumentation. This is very much sort of a emotionalist argument. It's just basically saying in order to, and it's very symbolic, in order to understand nature using reason, you got to kill it. You got to kill that bird, open it up, you know, mess with all of its insides. You know, you get this view of sort of, you get this image in your head of like sort of a devious, moralless scientist just, you know, screwing around with the internal organs. And you actually get this view of art in art of scientists a lot of times, you know, this mad scientist. If you counted up the number of good scientists in art and bad and mad scientists who have this sort of devious, you know, kind of, you know, love of destruction, that is tied to their love of knowledge. I think it would be about half and half at best. There'd probably be more mad scientists. And this view of scientists comes from this romanticist view that, well, you murder to dissect. A very negative view of reason indeed. So we've reached what appears to be the climax of the Kantian influence. Total admitted irrationalism. Reason is not only powerless, but it's actually dirty, immoral, and corrupting. And we are to use our emotions to gain knowledge about the earth instead. And so as a result, Schopenhauer offers no argumentation for any of his metaphysics. He just simply states it and expects you to feel the same way about it, basically. We have witnessed basically the death of the Greek project of philosophy. We've even reverted more even to a lower level than revelation. Instead of coming up with complex systems of how God is supposed to work that are supposed to reflect reality in some way, you know, on some level these myths are supposed to reflect some kind of physical reality. You know, why is it that there are stars in the sky? Oh, because a hummingbird poked holes in the wool in the sky, you know, like, at least that is attempting to explain stuff somewhat, to have some kind of story behind it. But instead of coming up with some kind of systematic mystic story, Schopenhauer basically says, well, no, we're not even supposed to have some kind of story behind it. It's all feeling. So it lowers man almost to the animal level. He's no longer man under Schopenhauer. Under Schopenhauer's philosophy, you would not even be a savage. You would not even raise yourself to the level of a savage who is sacrificing his own brothers to the gods. You'd be a retarded child, basically, who just does not even look for explanations to things. He just sits there, contemplates nature, and just breathes in the emotional vibes from it. Whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. I mean, well, so look, I don't want to diminish the aesthetic experience one can have from being out in nature. That's certainly a beautiful experience. It can be very relaxing, very meaningful. It can give you great feelings of like, I'm happy to live in this world. I'm happy to just be out here to listen to the birds, you know. And, you know, think about that. Your mind somehow gains pleasure just from the songs of birds, just from the whoosh of the leaves in the trees. And I don't want to diminish that. But Schopenhauer, you know, basically takes this very healthy value that people can have for this type of emotional experience, and he raises it to the level of a cognitive faculty. He basically says, down with reason, down with everything that would allow us to enjoy the sound, you know, of the birds in the fields. and just simply focus on your emotions. Because, I mean, if we didn't have technology and stuff, then we'd never go outside. Because, you know, we'd be, well, we wouldn't go outside for fun anyway, because we'd be, we wouldn't have any houses. We'd be sitting out there burning in the sun, and the songs of birds would be the last thing that we, that was on our minds. We'd be focused on not starving if we didn't use reason, if we had it Schopenhauer's way. Let's move on to his ethics before I get too angry. Well, actually, this will make me way more angry. So, again, Schopenhauer believed that the world was just one big, giant, irrational will. Will, by its very nature, Schopenhauer claimed, is always striving for something, always willing, always always desiring. But at the end of the day, it wills only to continue willing. It exists only to continue its existence. So consciousness can kind of be, for Schopenhauer, this universal consciousness can be compared to man's life itself. Man lives only to continue living. He eats only to continue eating, to continue. And that sounds like a pretty good deal to me. I live to continue living and continue being happy and all that. But Schopenhauer thought that this was essentially, it was essentially a miserable existence. Life essentially has no purpose. It's always striving towards something and never getting it. And as a result, life is miserable. Man is constantly frustrated. And each individual is destined for lifelong misery. The only thing that our wills can hope for is some kind of momentary relief that comes from getting something we want. And for these brief moments, we don't feel pleasure, says Schopenhauer. We just feel kind of what we call pleasure is just a relief from pain. And then we go back to desiring the something else, and we continue with the pain and frustration that comes from not getting it. And it's important to say sort of the, this isn't a philosophical opinion, like an intellectual position. I mean, clearly Schopenhauer didn't really even have intellectual positions, because it was all just stuff he literally pulled out of his feelings. So, but this was the kind of emotional tone of what Schopenhauer thought the universe was like. He didn't think of the universe, you know, he didn't feel as though the universe was this kind of epic suffering that you would experience in a tragic hero, say like Oedipus Rex. Oedipus is a strong warrior. He's a thinker. He's trying to outflank his destiny by, you know, taking certain measures to avoid his father and mother so that he doesn't kill his father and marry his mother. You know, he takes specific actions to try and do this, but he's destined towards defeat. But he's a tragic hero. There's a lot of dignity to his frustrations and his sorrow. Schopenhauer did not see life like this. He did not see it as an epic tragedy, but rather an absurd tragedy, allowing no dignity to the pride or suffering, no dignity or pride, you know, to the suffering that one endures in life. You know, Schopenhauer's protagonist, if he were to write one, would not be one who suffers the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. It would be more like Walter White, who gets frustrated trying to win back his wife's love in Breaking Bad. And when he gets frustrated, he tries to win his wife's love back by offering her and the kids pizza and breadsticks and dipping sticks. And so, you know, Schopenhauer would see it as this, you know, man as this absurd Walter White trying to win his wife back with dipping sticks and pizza. And when it doesn't work, he throws the pizza in an epic gesture of frustration. But he doesn't even, he can't even experience that, because when he throws the pizza, it just ends up on the roof. And just, you know, completely, there's no dignity to the suffering of Walter White. It's just absurd. He's a clown who can't even express his rage in a dignified way. So at this point, myself and a great many others apparently ask the following question: if life is really that bad, Schopenhauer, then why don't you just shut up and die? Now, Schopenhauer did, in fact, entertain the idea of suicide on this premise, but he said that this wouldn't do him or anyone else any good. Remember, individuality, according to Schopenhauer, is an illusion. We're all just part of this subconscious, of this superconsciousness that is existence. Killing ourselves would only wipe out one aspect of the universal consciousness. The consciousness itself would remain, continuing its Sisyphean existence of constant striving and disappointment. As a result, what he advocated was for all of humanity to efface their own wills and desires. All of humanity. They should practice altruism and asceticism to live for other people as a means of destroying their own desires and their own wills. What this would do, in Schopenhauer's view, would be effectively to eliminate all human beings on Earth. In this moral condition, humanity would be a herd of emotionless husks who have no desire for happiness for themselves. In effect, Schopenhauer believed that all humanity should commit mass suicide, not by taking their own lives, but by consistently practicing a code of self-sacrifice. The way that this works is that if you dedicate yourself to, think of the man who really dedicates himself completely, 100% to some kind of altruistic premise. He has to be in a state of constantly sacrificing his own happiness, his own life, to other people. He has to, every time he wants to do something, he has to say, well, wait, I got to do something else. Say, I want to go to the movies, that Jurassic Park movie, that looks good. But he says, wait, instead of watching Jurassic Park, I could be feeding the poor. I could be, scrubbing out toilet bowls for the injured. I could be doing something that sacrifices myself for the good of others. So at all moments, the consistent altruist seeks to destroy himself and his own happiness in order to help others. This Schopenhauer, I think, accurately says would eliminate the will. If you really desire no happiness for yourself, you're destroying that which makes you you. You have no desires other than your own. You become utterly selfless. And I don't use that word to mean something good. I mean, I use it to mean the most hideous kind of subhuman state you could imagine. A non-human state, really. Someone who has no pulse, no vitality in their person. So Schopenhauer says, renounce your own desires, every opinion you value. Remember, if you really want to eliminate the self, you should eliminate your opinions, too. You should eliminate your intellectual values. Say you really, let's say you even value something like communism. You just always want to argue with other people, try and convince them of communism. Schopenhauer would say that's sort of selfish. That's part of your will. That's part of something you want. That's something you feel strongly about. It's your idea. Eliminate it. That is to be thrown out with everything else. We are to all break our wills. And as a result, Schopenhauer believed that if all men destroyed their own wills, destroyed their own, desire to live, then this would in fact eliminate the mass consciousness that is the universe, and the universe would come to an end. We would finally, says Schopenhauer, receive the gift of death. So, literally, Schopenhauer wanted nothing less than the destruction of the entire universe as the purpose of his moral philosophy. I cannot think of anything more evil than that. So you're supposed to renounce your own desires, every opinion you value, everything that you desire makes you happy. Schopenhauer's ideal man is a solitary monk who doesn't speak, who has no life in his eyes, who eats only enough to prolong his existence of physical and spiritual starvation. Perhaps you would say, though, that Schopenhauer misses the point of altruism. You might say, well, wait, altruism, its point is not to destroy yourself, but to raise up the selves that are other people. Altruism is all about love for other people, right? I actually don't think so. And this is a point made by objectivism, which comes later in the 20th century. Which is a philosophy that I very much agree with. And I think you can, this point from objectivism can help us understand Schopenhauer. I don't think that altruism is fundamentally about helping other people. There is that aspect to it that they talk about. They do say it's about helping other people, but I don't think that is its primary goal. And here's how I could show you. Let's think about the moral credit given to Sir Isaac Newton versus some kind of ascetic monk who, you know, feeds the poor. I think altruism would unequivocally give the monk more moral credit. Why? Well, because Isaac Newton lived a pretty posh existence. You know, Isaac Newton was probably a very happy man. He sought the things that he desired in life. He certainly had unusual desires, and I believe he died a virgin. But he was passionate about it. If I was that smart, I don't know if I'd be looking at girls either. His life was a constant exploration through the things that man had never before seen. And so he probably lived a very happy life. At the very least, you would say that he was sort of selfish in the fact that he dedicated himself completely to his own desires. Whether those desires actually led to his happiness or not, we're not sure. I don't know much about Isaac Newton personally. But he was at the very least, we would say he was selfish in that he was trying to achieve his desires. The ascetic monk, on the other hand, sacrifices himself. He lives a life of solitude in order to help other people, in order to feed the poor, in order to help the sick, etc. And he lives in total, he does not charge for these services of feeding and medicine. He does them for free and completely out of charity. Now, because of this, the monk gets more moral credit under the code of altruism. But think about it. Who actually helped humanity more, Isaac Newton or this monk? There's no question that Isaac Newton and the technology that was brought forth through his ideas was much more beneficial to humanity than any amount of sacrificing this individual monk would be able to do. Why is it then that the monk gets more moral credit even though his contribution to humanity is dwarfed by that of Isaac Newton? It's because the monk damaged himself more. He sacrificed more. His life was more miserable as a result of his efforts. So this reveals the purpose of altruism, which Schopenhauer understood. The primary purpose of altruism is not to help others, but to destroy the self. And in Schopenhauer, we see the mask that altruism wears completely ripped off. Schopenhauer advocates for altruism not as a means of ameliorating the suffering of others, but as a means to destroy the individual will. As evil as Schopenhauer's purpose was, I gotta give him moral credit. He shows what altruism actually is about. Now, this view has remarkable similarities to Buddhism. Buddhism also identifies desire as the cause of all human despair and advocates purging it so that one can join with the world's spirit. Although it depends on how you interpret Buddhism, some Buddhist sects believe that once one eliminates one's desires, you will die inside. And so this sort of death through elimination of the will is achieved in the same way that Schopenhauer advocates for it. Schopenhauer already thinks that we're part of this world spirit, and our goal should be the destruction of the entire world spirit so that we can all feel at peace finally. Schopenhauer identified saints of many different religious practices, people who lived up to this moral goal of renouncing all aspects of the self and achieving this state of living death. The funny part is that Schopenhauer himself did not live ascetically. As a later philosopher, Bertrand Russell, observed, "He habitually dined, well, at a good restaurant. He had many trivial love affairs, which were sensual but not passionate. He was exceedingly quarrelsome and unusually avaricious. It is hard to find in his life evidence of any virtue except kindness to animals. In all other respects, he was completely selfish." According to Bertrand Russell, that was a bad thing. It is difficult to believe that a man who is profoundly convinced of the virtue of asceticism and resignation would never have made any attempt to embody his convictions in his practice. So, in other words, he was a frickin' hypocrite. Schopenhauer actually says for himself that he doesn't need to follow his own ethics. He says, quote, "It is therefore just as little necessary for the saint to be a philosopher as for the philosopher to be a saint. Just as it is not necessary for a perfectly beautiful person to be a great sculptor, or for a great sculptor himself to be a beautiful person." Unquote. In other words, I know I'm a hypocrite, but it doesn't matter. It still allows me to put forth these virtues, even though I myself do not practice them. What a bastard. On a personal note, I've never read about someone I hate more than Arthur Schopenhauer. I realize that Kant, as a philosopher, probably did more damage to philosophy by fundamentally changing it into something that voided its own purpose. So in a sense, Kant was the worst innovator, and you couldn't have had Schopenhauer without Kant. But I gotta say, Schopenhauer's denial of everything good is so complete, so consistent, that I really do think he is the most evil philosopher we've covered so far, and perhaps the most evil philosopher in all of history. I actually physically have trouble reading his ideas because I just simply start boiling with rage and the urge to vomit. This is a man who desires the destruction of everything I hold dear. He does not just cast doubt on the faculty of reason, but he actively denounces it as immoral. He denies the existence of the individual. He denounces science as superficial and unimportant during a time in human history when the fruits of the Enlightenment were expanding man's lifespan and happiness in unimaginable ways. He was too pathetic to live a happy life, even in the posh existence he was born into. So he preached giving up on life and desire. Being too full of hatred for mankind to simply remove himself from the world, he tells us all to practice altruism and self-denial so that he can watch us all skin our egos alive and live as sniveling nothings without desire or intellect. This is a man that wants the destruction of not only everything I hold good, but of the destruction of anything that makes life or happiness possible. Schopenhauer, to me, represents the climax of Kant's system in both ethics and epistemology, removing all that is good from what was once the noble project of Greek philosophy.